Our guest today is a distinguished retired federal appellate judge who at one point was a potential nominee for the U.S. Supreme Court. Joe Greenaway grew up in New York City, attended Bronx High School of Science, Columbia College, class of 1978, Harvard Law School, class of 1981. He was a federal prosecutor in New Jersey from 1985 to 1989. In 1996, he became a U.S. district judge in the District of New Jersey, sitting in downtown Newark. In 2010, he became a federal appellate judge, covering Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware in the years 2010 to 2023, nominated by President Barack Obama. He retired from the federal bench in 2023. He's now practicing law. He has also been a trustee of Columbia University, like me, and he is a WBGO listener. Judge Joseph Greenaway, thank you for joining us. Thank you for joining All Things Soul. I look forward to our discussion.
Thank you, Jay. My pleasure.
Okay. So I want to ask you a little bit about your background. You grew up in New York, and you attended Columbia College, and you were a baseball player at Columbia College. What position did you play?
I played a lot of bench, but when I got on the field, I was a catcher. My problem was I was the last year of no freshman eligibility, for varsity. So I was on the freshman team, and the captain of the baseball team when I was a freshman was a catcher. During my sophomore year, the captain of the freshman of the varsity was also a catcher. So there was a lot of sitting.
Yeah.
But it was a lot of fun.
But eventually you became a regular, right?
I did.
Became first string. Okay. I'm assuming you were a right-handed hitter and thrower, right?
I was indeed.
Okay. And were you a power hitter or did you hit for average?
Well, it all depends. In high school, I was a power hitter. I could reach the stands. In college, did not hit many home runs.
Okay. Now, when you were a catcher for Columbia, one of the people you often caught was a guy by the name of Rolando Acosta, who Columbia College, Columbia Law School, who became a distinguished New York State jurist. And the two of you must have been an awesome battery, correct?
We were, but let's not get it twisted. The real star was Rolando Acosta. He was all Ivy. He was a fantastic pitcher, really knew the game, had different delivery points, had four kinds of pitches. He was really great.
And he, of course, went on to become a Supreme Court justice in New York State, Appellate Division First Department, and like you and me, became a trustee of Columbia University and set a lot of pitching records, as I recall, collegiate, right?
Absolutely. He holds, I'm not sure if they're still on the books, but he held lots of records at Columbia for a long time, and lots of Ivy records as well.
And he was at one point recruited by the Cincinnati Reds, if I'm not mistaken. Is that correct?
Oh, listen, I think the only thing that hurt him from having a professional career is his love of the law. And the fact that he was such a good student, he graduated first. So he was coming into the possibilities of playing professionally at 21, 22. A lot of times, you have 16, 17, 18-year-olds who are fantastic, like Derek Jeter, getting drafted out of high school.
Right, right. So he opted for law school.
He did.
Okay. So, Joe, what do you think of the game today? What do you think of, you and I are the same age. We were both born in 1957. First of all, who were your idols, baseball idols growing up? I know who mine were, but who were yours?
Yeah, I fell in love with Bob Gibson because my earliest baseball memory is the 67 series between the Cardinals and the Red Sox. And I just remember seeing Gibson strike out Reggie Smith, who played for the Red Sox and had that, big afro. I was a Cardinal fan, and when they lost to Detroit in 68, I was crushed. And then
But that was the year Gibson had a 1.12 ERA, right?
he did 22-9, 1.12 ERA, and went up against Mickey Lolich, I want to say three times in the series that year. And Lolich, as you know, didn't look like a pitcher, probably couldn't pitch today because he wasn't a fit person. But really, that he was my first, real life. Of course, you read stories about, Jackie Robinson and Willie Mays ostensibly was near the end of his career. Hank Aaron was still playing, very strong. I appreciated what he did historically, but he wasn't the kind of person that we saw a lot in those days. The Cardinals were on because they were in the World Series, and in those days, before 69, you had no playoffs.
That's right.
You go right to the series. So that was, having seen him in 67 and then seeing him in 68, Gibson just had left an indelible impression.
So who were your idols behind the plate, since given that you were a catcher in college?
You know what? I was too young to appreciate Elston Howard. He was I was literally a baby when he was still catching. So I didn't grow up seeing him. I loved Bench. Bench kind of was a kind of a stocky fellow, and just as quick as can be. I loved Tim McCarver. He was a Cardinal, and then became the great broadcaster. Of course, I read about people like Josh Gibson and so forth, and that was inspiring. And obviously Campanella had his accident, I think, before we were born, or just as we were being born. So, I didn't get to see him, although I certainly admired what he did.
I don't want to lose half our audience, but are you a Yankee or a Mets fan, or are you still a St. Louis fan?
No, I'm Yankees. I came over to the dark side in 77 when Reggie came because our high school colors were the same colors as the Oakland A's. And that and you know I follow I love to follow people, and when Reggie hit that home run at the in the I guess it was the 69 All-Star game, out of I guess
Oh, 1971. I'm going to fact check you there.
71, was that it?
Tiger Stadium, '71.
You're 1,000%.
Right.
When he hit it out of Tiger Stadium, and then of course they had the same colors, so we had white shoes, we had the same stirrups and so forth. It was easy to root for him. And then he went to Baltimore for the year and then went to the Yankees, and I was just like, okay, we're rooting for the Yankees.
So, Judge Greenaway, you were a federal prosecutor early in your career for a couple of years in the District of New Jersey. The role of United States Attorney is in the news a lot these days. And I should note, by the way, for our audience, this interview was pre-recorded on October 8th. It will air October 18th, but it's pre-recorded on October 8th. But the role of the United States Attorney, the mention of U.S. attorneys, been a lot in the news lately. Could you just give our audience, who are not lawyers for the most part, a description of what a U.S. attorney does?
So at this point, there are either 93 or 94 districts in the United States. Each of those districts has a United States attorney. And the ostensible purpose of having a United States attorney is to prosecute federal crimes. Oftentimes, the state prosecutors work in unison with federal prosecutors, but ostensibly, the key role of a U.S. attorney is federal prosecution. And federal prosecution takes on, many different looks, many different hats. Making a misstatement to Congress comes within the ambit of federal prosecution. Committing certain kind of drug offenses comes within the ambit of that. Certain fraud claims, it could be bank fraud, it could be securities fraud. They come within the ambit of the U.S. Attorney's Office. And I think that when I was in law school, I was introduced to a federal prosecutor. I was a TA in a class for federal criminal litigation. And, I met this federal prosecutor who was helping the professor on it. And it was amazing just hearing about the cases. And one thing I had learned from someone that you might know, Dick Lowe, was in the
Yes.
Manhattan DA's office when I was in college, and he came to speak to us. And he said something that really stuck with me, that in the, criminal dynamic of judge, prosecutor, and defense attorney, that it was really the prosecutor that had the discretion. And of course, after the advent of the guidelines with regard to sentencing, that really constrained the discretion that judges had.
Yeah.
Defense
You know,
attorney.
if I could
Yeah.
interrupt, I once heard
Please.
one of your colleagues on the federal bench say, with the advent of the federal sentencing guidelines, I merely preside at a hearing conducted by the prosecutor.
Yeah, that is both funny and fair.
Yeah,
So,
right.
but what Dick Lowe said to me, and this was I guess in 77 or maybe 78, was that in that dynamic, it's really the prosecutor who can exercise its discretion not to prosecute, or to prosecute to a lesser offense, or in appropriate circumstances to prosecute to a more serious offense. And that stuck with me along with the experience I had in law school. So I wanted to become a federal prosecutor. And I think that the people that I've met who have become U.S. attorneys, Sam Alito was the U.S. attorney for part of my tenure. And it was, and of course, both of us have many friends who became the U.S. attorney in our respective districts. And I have a lot of respect for the office. And it is a weighty responsibility.
How common is it for someone appointed by the president as a U.S. attorney to be someone who has no prior experience as a prosecutor?
I think that's extremely rare. In the District of New Jersey, I would say, as far back as I've studied, even way back before I was in the office myself, I'd say it's only happened twice that I can remember. Chris Christie and the most recent appointment by President Trump, which has gone through some
Oh, yeah.
difficulties.
Yes.
And I think that the fact that it is so rare says a lot about why you want someone who's in the office, because you want someone who sort of understands from experience, not from being told, what the office is about, what the traditions of the office are about. And the fact that the appointing president should not make a difference in the way the office and its business is conducted. So priorities change. When I was in the office in the 80s, President Reagan was president. And so one of the priorities of the administration was drug prosecutions. So a lot
Yes.
of money was provided for drug prosecutions. Hence, being chief of narcotics kept me very busy. I worked with the DEA a lot, the FBI, et cetera, et cetera. But the key thing is, everyone at that time, who became a U.S. attorney was someone who had been in the office. Sam Alito, before he became U.S. attorney, had done other things in the government, but early in his career, after he clerked, he was in the appellate group in the U.S. Attorney's Office, and interestingly, worked at one point for Marianne Trump Barry.
Right. I read this morning in researching for this interview that you actually filled Justice Alito's seat on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit when you became a federal appellate judge. I did not know that.
I did, and he was kind enough to come up from Washington and swear me in. And
Oh, okay.
he reminded me that I think he had replaced he had taken the spot in 1990 of John Gibbons.
Right. So your comment about drug prosecutions prompts a question. I also was a federal prosecutor in 1989, 1990, 91. It was the advent of federal sentencing guidelines. You had mandatory minimum sentences based upon the volume of the narcotics sold. There was a crack epidemic. And so my question is, did your views about narcotics prosecution specifically evolve from the time you were a prosecutor and then became a judge?
That's a great question. I think once you start reading the pre-sentence report from the perspective of someone who is going to mete out a sentence, it's just different. As a prosecutor, the person's pled, so there's no question whether they're guilty or not. They pled, or you've tried them. And so you're intimately, familiar with the facts. But when you are a judge, you're paying a lot of attention to, who these folks are, what they're about. And what I learned about sort of drug prosecutions is, I think at that time the federal, let's put crack aside for just one second as it relates to this particular comment. The federal government went through a process in the mid to late 80s of going after quote unquote kingpins, people who were moving a lot of weight responsible for organizations and so forth. And I think, as a matter of priority, that was the right way to go. I never agreed with the notion of spending a lot of time and resources on users. That didn't seem to me to be a good federal priority.
Right.
And then crack came along, and as is true of many new things on any market, there was a lot of misinformation about crack. Obviously, an addictive drug. It's not a palliative for anyone, but I think that some of the thought about the deleterious effects of crack on people, its addictive quality, some of that was overstated, and I think some of that led to the enormous disparity in sentencing guidelines. I sentenced a fellow once. It was his third offense, and it was a vial of crack, but it was a third offense,
Right.
and as such he was subject to a mandatory minimum. And I think I as I recall, it was 10 years. He's a young man, probably in his 20s, maybe early 30s, and he went screaming out of the court. He was like, "It was a vial. It was a vial." And it struck me at the time that what's our focus as we think about drug offenses. I have no sympathy for drug offenders who are moving weight, who are leading organizations. They deserve what the statute provides. But it's those people who sort of fall into what I would say the user or personal use category that I think at times basically fall by the wayside, as it were,
When you look back at your time as a federal trial judge, trying cases, hearing cases, sentencings, pleas, civil cases, what are some of your prouder moments as a federal district judge?
You know, the one thing that I was most proud of as an individual was, you know, never making decisions, you know, purely on, you know, passion, desire, my you know, personal predilections, whatever. You know, I tried to be very you know, down the middle, as it were, in decision making. I, you know, what I've thought of judging then and now is, you shouldn't be able to pick up something that I've written and say I'm a liberal or a conservative. You should just pick up something I've written and said this is a well-reasoned opinion. You know, the judge understood the law, the judge applied the law to these facts, and the judge came to a reasoned decision.
Right. Although I'm going to push you on this a little bit. Judges are human too.
Oh, that doesn't mean I didn't
Everyone.
make mistakes, but that was my intent with regard to everything that I considered
Right.
and then
Right.
wrote. But I tell you one moment that I tell you know, students about, and I had a case. It was in 99, and it had to do with it was Ford versus Iwanoa, and it had to do with slave labor during World War II. People of all faiths were slave laborers at a Ford plant that had been taken over by the Reich. And this suit was seeking remuneration. And I will tell you, just as a human being, I was like, we got to find a way to make this happen.
Right.
You know, and try as I might, you know, the law didn't let me. And you know, I think that, you know, some would say you should have come up with a way, and I didn't think that was the role of a judge. You know,
Right.
my heart said find a way, but the law said no, there is no way. So I wrote an opinion. I think it was like a 120-page opinion that was not appealed, interestingly. You know, saying that, you know, I looked at it every which way. I think there were maybe 10 claims, and ultimately the dispositive claim was non-justiciability. But you know, I was at one of those points where I said, I'm going to make this easy for the Third Circuit. I'm going to rule on everything, so you know, they can choose however they may to, you know, either affirm or reverse or vacate and remand. And I thought that that tested me as a judge. That this isn't really about, you know, what as a private citizen I may think about something. This is really about you playing a role in our democracy.
Right. So in 2010, President Obama appointed you to the United States Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit. It's an appellate court, of course, where you hear arguments, read briefs, and make a decision, versus being a trial judge where you're interacting more with people every day, people who appear for you every day trying cases. And so, and from everything I know, it's a more isolated existence on the appellate court. You're someone I know to be very outgoing. You like being around people. What
I
was the
do.
thought process that went into accepting an appointment as an appellate judge, and what were the principal differences?
Well, I'll tell you a funny story. So, I had a magistrate judge who worked with me, Madeline Arleo, and I tease her that she was so good at her job that my job as a district judge was getting boring. So
Ha ha.
I love the idea, but I'll tell you another story about this. So I used to eat lunch with a fellow judge named Harold Ackerman, with some regularity, and as the election of 2008 approached, he said, "Yeah, I understand there are some openings. You should see if this might work out. I think you really like it." And I hadn't really thought about it much. And as you noted, it all worked out. I thought that going to the Court of Appeals was really the jolt I needed on a personal level to sort of be really engaged in the law and just really excited about the law. And I didn't, I don't find really anything isolating. I can have fun in a room by myself. But what I loved about the Court of Appeals was the interaction with my clerks. It was a little more intense just because of the way your work is structured, and the sort of intellectual interaction with my colleagues. When you're on the district court, there is no intellectual engagement with your colleagues because they have cases,
Right.
you have cases, and never the
Right.
twain shall meet, right? Because I don't need to talk to you, Jay, how do I figure this out? That doesn't
Right.
happen as a district judge, but as a circuit judge, I need a vote. And if I'm
You're
going
sitting on
to,
a panel of three people, right?
exactly. So I need one of them to go along with me, and that process of persuasion is a very unique situation, right? Because in the law, other than appellate courts, there are very few instances where you have to convince one or two people of a proposition that can change the entire result that you're going for. Because when you're trying, you've been a trial lawyer forever. When you're trying cases, you have your team, the other side has their team, and it's like rock 'em sock 'em robots. You're trying to beat each other to the punch. When you're on the appellate court, there's no beating someone to the punch. You it's all, how do you think about something? How do I persuade? There were times I'd have to write, memos to my colleagues, aside from bench memos and draft opinions, just to try and persuade them that they should come my way on a vote. And
Right.
I found that to be, exciting might be a strong word, but really intellectually challenging. And on the Third Circuit, where it was really about the marketplace of ideas, while I was there, it wasn't like, this one's a conservative, he's not going to vote for me. That one's a liberal, they're not going to vote for me. I suppose some might from the outside say that that was the way it was. I didn't find that to be so. And I thought the job, sort of, number one, sharpened my analytical skills, and number two, made me sort of a little more aware of how I was thinking things. People from the outside always want to know what influences judicial decision making. And sometimes you have to check yourself, like, why am I making this decision? What are the factors that are going into this decision? Because, your allusion to we're all human, to me, is not about, getting it right or wrong. It's about what is your process of thinking? How are
Right.
you getting from A to B? And what are the influences on how you're thinking about something?
Okay. So let me ask a more global question about the federal judiciary. Federal courts these days, at every level of the federal courts, are facing very difficult issues concerning deploying the state National Guard and federal status. Use of what I would consider an arcane authority like the Alien Enemies Act, allegations of politically motivated criminal prosecutions. This president's entire tariff policy is now going to the U.S. Supreme Court. In my judgment, the federal courts are under unprecedented stress and strain, at least in my lifetime and yours. What's your overall assessment of how the federal judiciary is doing in the face of a lot of challenges of executive branch actions?
Listen, I think there's never been greater stress on the third branch, and I think the stress is, I think it's fair to say that the president's actions are unprecedented in number and scope, and it's really in the hands of the judiciary. What the future of executive authority is going to be, right? Because as it's defined, particularly as it's defined by the Supreme Court, right? Because although the Roberts Court, which is now 20 years old, has been probably the court that has re-examined precedent more than any other. Until the Roberts Court goes through some sort of transformation, we know what the views of these nine people are going to be. And so when you have a decision made in the last 6 months and for the next 3.5 years, it's unlikely going to be re-examined in the short term. So we now, with the decisions that are coming out, we're now going to have a view for the next few years of what executive power is going to look like. And I think that the lower courts, the circuit court and the Supreme Court are in unprecedented territory because have we seen the use of older statutes like the Alien Enemies Act before used? Yes, we have. Have we seen politically motivated prosecutions? Yes, we have. Have we seen tariffs used in ways that are brought question by some in the financial world? Yes, but we haven't seen them all at the same time. To me, what's unprecedented and what is putting a strain on the system, so to speak, is just the volume. Right. I mean, we saw it early on in the administration just by the number of executive orders. I mean,
Yep.
the executive order is something that's been used by every president in the last generation. That's not new. And the fact that it is undoing something that the prior administration has done as a general matter is not new. What's new here is that the executive orders went into untrodden territory, right? Things that
Right.
we
Like
never thought.
birthright citizenship, for example.
Birthright citizenship, what it's done to the legal profession, I think is unprecedented. And I think that the true test. You and I know that what the key to a federal judiciary is life tenure and not having to worry about ostensibly about politics, right? Am I going to be replaced? Am I going to lose an election? This and that. That's not part of what federal judges have to be concerned about. And I know that I took great solace in that fact while I was on the bench. I was like, who cares whether this is viewed as this liberal or conservative or whatever? This is what I think. And
Well,
here's what.
that leads me to my next question, which is, are federal judges immune from politics?
Everything depends on the individual. It'd be foolish to say that they're immune. It depends on how you view it, right? I mean, so
Yeah.
for instance, when were you appointed? Who appointed you? If you're appointed for a judge that I'm sorry, if you're appointed by a president who's been out of office for 20 years, are you really worried about how that president thinks about you? Now, famously, Eisenhower said his two biggest mistakes were Warren and Brennan. Did either Warren or Brennan, worry about what Eisenhower thought about what they were doing? No. I can candidly say I never gave a moment's thought to how any decision that I made might be perceived by, Democrats or Republicans. Yeah, that just was not important to me. Now, it'd be foolish to say that I think every federal judge thinks the same way. I know that that's, would be naive. However, the theory behind appointing people to life tenure is so, and the thing that your listeners might not appreciate is we are cloistered in the sense of, what our interaction with the profession and others can be. In other words, there are, both official and artificial ways in which we're sort of kept out of the fray so that politics will be kept to a minimum. We can't contribute to, candidates and so forth. And I think that particularly at a time like this in our nation's history, that system of sort of isolation, if you will, certainly the system of life tenure is more important than ever because you want to make sure that there is nothing institutionally or systematically that will get in the way of, your decision making. Is decision making pure? Of course not. All judges come to the bench with life experiences. If you come to the bench as a person of color, you don't leave that at the door. And I can tell you many instances where, my colleagues who didn't share my life experience looked at a particular set of facts and came to one determination. I looked at that same set of facts, came to an entirely different because I had lived the life that, of the person involved, and to a certain extent, and I knew that there were circumstances that arise that present different challenges depending on who you are and where you are.
Last legal and perhaps most difficult question for you that I know a lot of people want to, people have asked me all the time. Lawsuit is brought, federal district judge issues a temporary restraining order or a preliminary injunction directed at the executive branch. You are hereby directed to not put so and so on an airplane and deport that person to Venezuela or El Salvador, hypothetically. And the president, the executive branch, the Secretary of Homeland Security says, no, I refuse. I'm sending this person back to Venezuela or El Salvador. What's the recourse in that circumstance?
Well, it's always been famously said that we don't have the power of the sword. So, judges can only do so much. I thought your question was going to be slightly different, because I had instances where the person's on their way to the airport or the person's at the airport. Petition comes in front of me. I read it. I grant the stay. Don't let the person go. And sometimes the person gets on the plane. And what I've been told by the government in those instances when I was still on the bench is, the person's on the plane. When he gets there, we have no ability to do that. And now we know that that's not true. right? There is an ability for our government to talk to whatever the other government is
Of
and,
course.
make arrangements. And
Right.
wouldn't we? Now, it'd be different, at least theoretically, if it were a country that we didn't have diplomatic reciprocity, but that's not the case in most of these types of instances. I think that that's always, I mean, that's Marbury versus Madison, right? I mean, do you force the president to act? And
Right. That's my question. Suppose the president says, "No, I'm not going to do that. I think you're exceeding your authority, judge. And if you don't like it, hold me in contempt or whatever. What do you do in that circumstance?"
I don't think there's anything for the judge to do other than, I mean, are you going to hold the president, assuming with your hypothetical that it's the president's order, are you going to hold the president in contempt, and who's going to enforce it,
Right.
right? Most law enforcement, whether federal or state, think of themselves, and rightly so, within the executive branch. It'd be difficult if you have the executive branch saying we won't do something. But I mean,
Right.
I mean, look, I'm sure you've spoken on this many times. I mean, that's the essence of, what our constitutional crisis
Right.
is.
That is truly a constitutional crisis, isn't it?
And but we are one step away from that at all times during this administration. I mean, theoretically at all times in any administration, right? But particularly in this administration, because we've seen there the there it's not hypothetical that there have been instances where the administration says we're not going to do that.
Right. That's right. And we've got another 3.5 or 3 1/3 years to look forward to. Judge Greenaway, last question for me, and thank you for this discussion. You and I were both born in 1957. I suspect our ear for music was developed at around the same time. Who are your favorite R&B artists?
Well, I have to tell you, I love Ray Charles.
I'm gonna love you like no one's loved you. Come rain or come shine.
I love Aretha Franklin.
Loving him a little bit for each day turns me right on when I hear him say, hey, baby, let's get away, let's go somewhere. Oh, baby, can we? Well, I don't care.
You know, there's just something about James Brown that's great. You know, there's something about all of those groups that we knew in the 70s, with their great dance moves and the lyrics, that there's, the OJs come to mind.
Ask me how I know, and I'll tell you so. She used to be my girl.
Well, you can also tell me what you told me before we started recording about your more contemporary taste.
Well, I mean, if you want to talk about contemporary tastes, I love rap music, and I love both the female rappers of today, and I love the old school Snoop, sprinkled with a little 50 Cent, and I think that rap is such a unique form of communication when you mix the lyrics with the beat. It is infectious, and I think that women have really struck a chord in the music business, and are they're just offering a literally a different sound.
Okay. Well, my hat's off to you. And Judge Greenaway, thank you for your time. Thank you for this
Absolutely.
very valuable discussion. I thank you on my own behalf and on behalf of WBGO. And please continue to be a supporter and a listener. Thank you.
No, thank you. Appreciate it, Jay.